Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Our coverage of Campaign 2024 continues with a look at environmental issues in the first state.
I think there are two overall areas in which there seem to be agreement on action. They don't necessarily agree on the particular kind of action, but there's a recognition that these are overarching problems.
Contributor John Hurl talked to candidates up and down the ballot about where they stand on key environmental issues. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also launch our Races to Watch series with the Democratic primary in House District 21 and learn how a University of Delaware lab is helping seniors become more active. Plus, History Matters previews a social justice dialogue hosted by the Delaware Historical Society. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As next month's Delaware primary election approaches, Delaware Public Media is ramping up its coverage of the races and issues important to Delawareans. Among the areas we want to examine are issues surrounding the first state's environment. Offshore wind, electric vehicles, forever chemicals, and sea level rise are just some of the topics that candidates are being asked to address to gauge their ability to lead on the environment. Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle recently spent time chatting with candidates up and down the ballot about the environmental challenges the state faces. His piece on what they had to say is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to delve into what he learned. So let's start with what I feel is like the most contentious issue, and that's the Advanced Clean Cars 2 program, or so-called EV mandate, that calls for 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware for sale to be zero-emission vehicles by 2032. This one is definitely getting some significant pushback from Republicans, correct?
That's right. I mean, this rule originally called for 100% of new cars sold in Delaware by 2030. To be zero emissions. Now, of course, that's now been rolled back in the way you described, Tom. And regardless of the precise timing or the exact percentage that the rule of zero emissions cars that the rule requires, yes, the Republicans are pushing back against that. They argue that the rule limits consumer choice. That there aren't enough public charging stations, and that the electric grid would need updating in order to provide electricity for all of the zero emission vehicles that the rule wants to install by 2032.
And interestingly, on the other side, many Democrats, while supportive of the general effort being made by the Advanced Clean Cars 2 program, seem to be a little cautious about fully leaning into this. What are they saying about it? Because it seems like some of the idea of like the timelines and the percentages are still a bit of an issue.
Well, one of the Democrats that I spoke to on this was Russ Huxtable, who's seeking re-election for a House seat in Sussex County. So he praised the rollbacks of the Clean Cars rule, saying that it gives consumers more choice, and it gives the state more time to decide whether to build out a EV infrastructure. We also had a response from Lieutenant Governor Hall Long, of course, one of the Democrats seeking the governorship, and she said that the revised target may even have to be revisited again. So I think those two right there are probably indications that, that maybe some Democrats still have some reservations about this plan.
And I'll just add as a side note, when we talked to Colin O'Mara, Democratic candidate for governor during our candidate conversations, he, who was probably the most progressive on some of these environmental issues, even said there is concern on his mind that they could boomerang on Democrats if they don't meet these particular benchmarks that would give opponents the kind of I told you so argument. So it is interesting to see how that's playing out. I do want to move on to another issue, John, and that's offshore wind, which is another one that's been in the headlines as Delaware, as you've reported, has been taking initial steps to procure wind energy offshore. How much support is adding offshore wind to the state's energy portfolio getting up and down the ballot?
Well, I mean, predictably, the Democrats do support offshore wind, but some recognize that the public needs to be more involved in decisions over siting wind farms offshore. I mean, one of those is Matt Meyer, currently the Newcastle County Executive, and he is saying that if he becomes governor, then he will seek buy-in from coastal communities who may be concerned about the visual or environmental impacts of wind farms. Colin O'Mara wants to minimise the environmental impact of any interconnections between the power cables that come from the offshore wind farms and the grid on land. On the GOP side, Mike Simpler, who is a candidate for District 14 in the State House, he did call for diversified energy sources, but he said that that offshore wind developers should have to pay upfront for the decommissioning of wind farms. That he's anticipating that in coming decades, when they've reached the end of their life, then the developers should commit upfront to paying the cost of taking those down.
We've also talked, you and I, a number of times about the Mach 2 hydrogen hub plan that's coming to Delaware and other states in the region. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Colin O'Mara is co-chair of that project, so we know he backs it. Are other candidates bullish on this concept of, in the case of this hub, you know, so-called green hydrogen?
Yes, there seems to be general agreement that the Mach 2 is a good thing. What I've heard from Lieutenant Governor Hall Long is that she calls Mach 2 a major opportunity for the Delaware economy and an important way of decarbonizing some sectors of the economy. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester, who of course is now running for the U.S. Senate, she's also a supporter of Mach 2, and points out that it's forecast to generate some 20,000 jobs across the region, not only Delaware, but southern New Jersey and southeastern Pennsylvania.
One of the things that supporters of Mach 2 point to, as you noted with Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, is its potential economic impact on job creation and more. Is that something that you're hearing from other candidates as well, that there's real opportunities for Delaware to tap into the green economy in general? And what role can government play or should play in supporting not just Mach 2, but other renewable energy projects?
There seems to be general agreement amongst the candidates on both sides of the aisle here that government does have a role to boost the use of Delaware's use of renewable energy. So, I mean, one example of that would be Matt Meyer on the Democratic side, says that if he's elected, he would electrify the state's vehicle fleet and build more EV chargers. On the Republican side, Eric Hansen, who is the GOP candidate for the U.S. Senate seat, he's calling on the federal government to put tariffs on products imported from India and China that are manufactured with coal and perhaps other forms of fossil fuels, and he says that he accused those countries of what he called poisoning the world, and therefore is advocating that the U.S. government should put tariffs on those products. Hansen is saying that's another way in which government can influence this debate.
So sea level rise, obviously a real threat to Delaware as the nation's lowest lying state. What are some of the positions you've heard on building resiliency against sea level rise in the state? Something, again, that we've talked about numerous times here on The Green with you.
Well, I mean, there seems to be general agreement that something needs to be done. I'm looking at a comment that was made by Marty Rendon, who is a Democratic candidate for the House seat in the 14th district, and he calls for what he calls monitoring coastal development. It's a little unclear as to what monitoring actually means. But then looking at Colin O'Mara's position on this, on sea level rise and the effect that it's having on Delaware, I mean, O'Mara gets a lot more specific. And he talks about the need to have what he calls the difficult conversations about moving some people in the most vulnerable areas to higher ground, and in a process that is generally referred to as managed retreat. I mean, he's talking about buying out houses. I mean, in a way that that New Jersey, for example, already does. Removing public infrastructure such as wastewater plants. On the Republican side, Kim Hoey Stevenson, who is a candidate for a Sussex County House seat, she called for building coastal barriers, moving infrastructure, and restoring wetlands as a way to protect the coast from sea level rise.
So, John, how about clean water and PFAS contamination? Is that getting much attention from the candidates in this election?
Well, I think it is. Candidates for both sides recognize that that is a problem. One of the Democratic proposals for this is simply to take advantage of developing technology to improve filtration by providers of public drinking water supplies.
Were there any other issues that candidates discussed that stood out to you, or maybe even surprised you when it comes to the environment?
Well, I think there are two overall areas in which there seemed to be agreement on action. They don't necessarily agree on the particular kind of action, but there's a recognition that these are overarching problems. One of them that we've already talked about a bit is sea level rise. Colin O'Mara is talking about managed retreat. Kim Stevenson again is talking about the need to build coastal barriers. So there's no denial that this is a problem that has to be addressed. And then the other general theme that emerged from this reporting was on environmental justice, and I was asking whether the candidates saw a need to provide special protection to underserved communities that have been disproportionately affected by environmental problems in the past. There seemed to be agreement on both sides that something needs to be done about environmental justice issues. So Sarah McBride, for example, a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House seat that's being vacated by Representative Blunt Rochester, she said that there was a need to remediate the past harm done on environmental justice communities. And Mike Ramone, Republican candidate for governor, said that the government has a responsibility to provide every Delawarean with the resources that they need.
You also reached out to environmental advocates to see how they feel about how these issues are being addressed. Do they feel candidates are paying enough attention to climate and environment?
I spoke with Dustin Thompson, the director of the Delaware Sierra Club, and his view is that however urgent these various environmental issues are, in his estimation, he thinks that the public is actually going to see other issues as more important in their decision on who to vote for in November. He was saying, for example, the protection of democracy, the reform of the Supreme Court, women's right to choose, in his view, those were all going to come ahead of environmental issues in the eyes of most voters.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on where the candidates stand on environmental issues in the first state is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We launch our Races to Watch series with a look at the Democratic primary in House District 21, where Republican Mike Ramone's decision to run for governor leaves a seat open and up for grabs. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The 21st House District seat in the Newark area is completely up for grabs this year. The incumbent Republican House Minority Leader Mike Ramone is exiting to run for governor, and a pair of Democrats see an opportunity to flip the seat. Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki talked to those Democrats to learn why they feel they can turn this seat blue.
Ramone has represented the 21st House District since 2009, but came close to losing the seat in each of the last three election cycles. In 2022, the race was so close that it required a recount, and Ramone won by just 35 votes. Frank Burns was the Democrat who forced that recount.
I'd spent the last 2 years going to his coffees, talking to people there after he left. There was a group of people, they actually had T-shirts, Democrats for Mike Ramone. And I would sit and chat, and when you're that close, peeling off a voter one at a time over a period of time actually works.
Burns filed just before the deadline in 2022, putting together a strong campaign that came up just short of unseating Ramone.
And I can understand it because we were starting late, and I have not been some sort of political operative in the state. I've worked with advocacy groups, but I haven't been, you know, running around trying to be Mr. Politician or anything. So I think a lot of people didn't really think I had a good chance. And so this time people realized differently. There was a lot more buy-in early on.
This time Burns announced his intent to run more than a year in advance. But that's not the only difference. He'll also need to survive a primary from one of his own former campaign staffers, Michael Alexander Smith. Not to be confused with current 22nd District GOP Rep. Mike Smith, is a former legislative aide for State Representatives Medina Wilson-Anton and Stephanie Bolden. Smith says he has a lot of respect for Burns and that the two had a great rapport working on Burns' 2022 campaign.
And if he wins the primary, I'll be very happy to support him, and I'll write him the check the next day. I will say that I think there's just a difference of priorities, right? There are some issues that I think are under-discussed down in Dover.
On most issues, Smith and Burns agree and would likely vote along Democratic Party lines for things like police reform, expanding voting rights, protecting access to abortion and gender-affirming care, and eliminating the death penalty. And they both agree on pursuing more environmental protections. Smith is executive director of the environmental nonprofit Powering Our Future. Under his leadership, the nonprofit has given out over 500 electric leaf blowers, 2,000 high-efficiency LED light bulbs, and dozens of electrification rebates. Smith supports legislative efforts by Representative Sophie Phillips to expand electric vehicle infrastructure and access and prevent invasive baitfish in Delaware waterways.
That's something that no one really thinks about because angling, fishing is not necessarily a discussed issue down in Dover unless we're talking about DENREC funding or permits or things of that nature. But we need to make sure that our waterways are biodiverse, make sure that they're healthy, make sure they're not polluted.
He adds work to replace lead pipes and remove lead from drinking water in schools is still ongoing and wants to see more preventative measures put in place to keep the water clean. Smith's nonprofit is also focused on keeping residents informed about air quality reports specific to their area, working with Newcastle County over a two-year period to increase the number of air quality monitors from 8 to 25.
And they are spread out across the county so the people can go to an app on their phone and they can see this is what the particulate matter pollution is in my neighborhood, because that's something that's incredibly important. You just don't need to know what's going on in Lummis Pond. You need to know what's going to happen in Pike Creek or what's happening in Claymont.
Burns grew up in Chicago in a family he describes as working poor. His college studies took him to Pennsylvania, where he ultimately earned a doctorate in biochemistry. He worked to help create DNA diagnostic kits and was among the first to bring them online for clinical use before working in environmental microbiology science and engineering for DuPont.
All of those projects sort of up and disappeared about the time Donald Trump got elected. So I saw the impact of politics on not only what the government did, but how private businesses were or were not taking on their responsibilities. That is what moved me from being sort of I'll donate to various things I believe in, and I think my contribution that I'm making to society is through my science and advancing things, to realizing the importance of more immediate political and policy changes.
Burns says he hears concerns from residents about whether state government will stand up and protect its residents.
People are more worried about, especially with our current Supreme Court, about things that we've always looked to the federal government to provide, whether it's the EPA and protection for the environment, rights to control your own body, LGBTQ things, all of those things now, we really need to have the state step up.
Burns says this means enshrining these protections in the state constitution. But to do so, Democrats need to pick up another House seat to have supermajorities in both chambers of the General Assembly. Smith agrees it's up to the state to protect rights and believes recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions striking down abortion rights, weakening the labor movement, and limiting executive branch agencies' ability to regulate the environment, public health, and other issues were incorrectly decided. In 2023, a Supreme Court ruling narrowed the scope of the Clean Water Act and the EPA's power to regulate waterways and wetlands. Burns says Senator Stephanie Hansen's bill creating a state non-title wetlands program is crucial and must pass next year. And beyond procuring offshore wind, Burns wants to see Delaware generate its own power rather than buying electricity and fossil fuels from out of state. Burns says he looks at things with a systems approach. He critiques the current committee structure in the state legislature, saying issues are too siloed. He points to housing, which he calls the root of many other social and economic issues, as a reason to break down those silos.
So I think housing is a key component because it underlies so many other issues that we have.
For example, he voices support for making accessory dwelling units easier to build and maintain, adding they solve multiple problems at once: housing, an aging population, and a dire need to cut down on fossil fuel use. Burns also argues housing plays a role in healthcare access issues, particularly in Sussex County, which is growing and aging.
You know, the staffing shortages are not just physicians. It's all up and down. And that's also in part tied into housing. Like, can people get a reasonable place to live at a reasonable price? And if they can't, then the chance that they're going to come and take a job here in Delaware is not good.
One of the legislature's major challenges next session will be addressing the state's education funding structure, the result of a settlement of a 2020 funding equity lawsuit. Burns sees housing connected to that issue, too.
And how that funding happens, I would like to see it more statewide rather than local. I think one of the underlying things that people miss is that students in some of the schools are very transient.
Smith is a substitute teacher in the Red Clay School District and says he sees how students' personal lives affect their performance at school. He says they need more resources for students that work jobs after school or are commuting up to an hour to get to school.
It's not just about your kids. It's about our workforce. It is about the people you see on the roads. It's about the people that you see in work. It's about having an educated community. And that's something I would really love to see, whether it be tinkering with funding, whether it be trying to put more resources into our teachers' pockets, trying to put more resources into apprenticeships and trade programs. There's a lot of things we can do.
But the issue Smith says has motivated him for nearly half of his life is road safety. And he believes it's often overlooked in the legislature.
Unfortunately, we're losing, roughly the same order of magnitude of Delawareans every year from accidents on our roads, as we're losing from overdoses, as we're losing from gun violence. This is a sneaky issue that isn't necessarily partisan, which is good because that means that we can pass bills.
Smith says he'll advocate for better transportation practices and services overall, too, like expanding accessibility and frequency for public transportation and adding more bike lanes and safe pedestrian crosswalks to roadways statewide. Smith is endorsed by Delaware Building Trades and the Delaware Pride Caucus. He says he brings legislative experience to the race, but also experience in education, the environment, and working with nonprofits.
If you end up winning, also going down Dover and not just being a vote for this or that, but for being someone who can propose legislation, who can work. That's what 80% of the job is. It's not just about going and voting at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday. It's about going to actually work on legislation.
Burns is endorsed by the Working Families Party of Delaware and Democratic State Senator Laura Sturgeon. He feels he can relate to independent and middle-of-the-road voters.
And I'm not a creature of the party. I've been an activist and everything, but I'm not, always been a party person. So I actually think I have a better appeal in the district.
This is a key race for Democrats. If they win this seat and the party holds all of its current House seats, Democrats would have supermajorities in the House and Senate. And registration numbers indicate it can happen. The House 21st has just over 8,000 registered Democrats and just under 5,000 Republicans, with about 5,900 independent or registered in other parties. Rachel Sawicki, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Rachel. The winner of this primary will face Republican Brenda Minella in November's general election in House District 21. Up next, how work being done at the University of Delaware's Active Lab is helping older adults get more physically active. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. More and more older adults are becoming less physically active. That's according to new data from the World Health Organization, which found that nearly 2 billion adults are at risk of disease from not engaging in enough physical activity. At the University of Delaware, the Active Lab, directed by Associate Professor of Physical Therapy Daniel White, is working to address the issue of creating practical ways to increase activity in older adults. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with White to explore the effects of prolonged sedentary behavior and ways to get older adults more physically active.
What do you make of the WHO's findings? Does any of that necessarily surprise you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, it definitely rings the alarm again for the need for all of us to be physically active. I think that it's important to recognize that the assumption that people might have that, you know, it's the modern day conveniences that, you know, we have. So the car ride and the desk jobs that contribute to our inactivity. While that is true, we as human beings are naturally inclined to be lazy. It is just a, let's just call it for what it is. We all want to sit. It is just built into our DNA and something that Daniel Lieberman, is an anthropologist from Harvard, has studied and talked about in his book, Exercise. We are programmed to be this way. So it's okay to sit. It's fine. But this World Health Organization report, you know, brings a long list of research that shows we can do a lot better than just sitting. And the health benefits of being active are, if you can put these into one pill, it'd be the miracle blockbuster drug we're all looking for. The health effects are so far reaching. They go from your mood and your well-being all the way to preventing cancer. It's an amazing laundry list of health benefits.
And for the listeners that can't see us right now, we are both sitting on this Zoom call. So, but Dan, anecdotally, why do you think then physical activity and sedentary behavior is such a struggle for older adults specifically? Is it because those kinds of habits, you know, weren't already established? Is it the, you know, the various health challenges that crop up as we age? Seniors and older adults, you know, the data shows there are very, very real isolation issues. Is it contextually based, you know, or is it kind of simplified in terms of what you said, where the default is to sit these days, especially, I would say, in this day and age that we live in? You know, what are those biggest factors that contribute to older adults and seniors not being physically active?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if I had the magic answer, we wouldn't have this problem. But as it turns out, it's a complex issue that involves a variety of factors. For seniors who are listening to this right now, I think I'd like to start with, you're not alone. There's a lot of people that are sedentary, that they spend a lot of time sitting. It is very common. And as I said before, it's in our biology. I think some of the added things as you get older that contribute to this, you know, from a psychological perspective, there is your confidence with doing things, what's something we call self-efficacy. And essentially what this means is that when you lose the confidence to do things, your behavior very much changes. And so, you know, as an older adult, as things become a little harder to do, as you lose strength, as mobility starts to go a little bit, your confidence starts to go. And, you know, you've seen this when you're climbing stairs. I've experienced this, like, just like, all right, I'm not so sure I want to do this tightrope walk anymore. I'm tired of falling. So that is one of the contributing factors. And I think another major one is, as you say, Kyle, is our social circles. They change. And, you know, older adults do become more isolated. And I think the socialization and getting involved with things that make you happy and get you out are so very important for a laundry list of reasons, not the least of which is it improves your activity. It improves how much you can do.
So the WHO said lack of activity puts us at greater, you know, risk of disease. Can you walk us through what kind of negative health effects occur as a result of inactivity at older ages?
As you age, unfortunately, what happens is there is a term called sarcopenia, and that is a wasting away of muscle that naturally happens. So we start to lose muscle mass at about 1% after the age of 26. So we are getting weaker and weaker just as the normal process of aging. The other major thing that happens is just your entire, all your body systems start to not work as well. So your flexibility in your joints, chronic disease starts to rear its ugly head in forms of things like a cardiovascular disease. So whether it's arteriosclerosis, whether it's a pulmonary disease, such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or it could be something as simple as you start to lose your eyesight and it's harder to see and to go out. And we use our eyesight a lot to help with balance. So all these systems, you know, with aging, limit how easy it is to just go out and do things. I will say that the good news is that a lot of these things are reversible and we can mitigate or lessen the burden or changes that happen over time by being active and by going for a walk, by riding a bike or a stationary bike. And in doing so, some of these age-related changes that we see, such as the muscle wasting, are actually reversed. Now, not all things are reversed, but definitely for your muscle, you can build muscle as you get older. And that will help you regain your independence if you've lost it, and definitely make you stronger and improve how confident you are to do things on a daily basis.
To follow up on that, so none of this is a guarantee as far as these negative health effects or, you know, these diseases that come with sedentary behavior, whether you're older or not. For those out there that want to address this, Dan, and want to start becoming, you know, more active, more physically active, what do you recommend as far as taking those first steps? Is it as simple as, you know, I'm just going to go for a walk today, you know, 10 minutes, and then tomorrow I'm going to try and do the same thing. Then you just kind of like stack the bricks, so to speak. What do those first steps look like?
That's a great question. How can I get started? You know, in the end, I've been in this game for almost 20 years now, you know, thinking about this issue. And, you know, my thought is that it is a social endeavor. Our activity, you know, back in prehistoric times was to go get food, to, you know, hunt things, to gather. And that's what activity came from. You know, it wasn't exercise. People weren't going to gyms in prehistoric times. Okay. It just wasn't around. No Planet Fitness. But nowadays, you know, we do have a lifestyle that is very much more predicated towards being sedentary. And we're living longer, which is great. But, you know, medical miracles and being able to prevent, you know, major things that used to kill people early on. We've done a great job as a society. But now the question is, how can we sustain the quality of life we have now that we have this expanded lifespan. And, you know, thinking about this, I think finding activities that you enjoy that are active and that is the key to this. And the reason I say this is, well, you know, you can say, well, look, if it's only going for a walk for 10 minutes a day, I'll just do that and we're done. Yes, that's true. But the problem is the sustaining of that for the long term. I mean, a lot of you listening maybe have had the experience that I've had where you get your gym membership and you go and, you know, it's fine. And everyone, you know, does their own thing. And then you go, but then you notice like, oh, I got so much else to do and I just don't feel like doing this. But, you know, if you have a group of people that you go with, your chances are being of sustaining that are better. Or better yet, if that group is more focused on the socialization aspect of things. So if it is a social club that walks, or if it is a bowling group or a dance group, I mean, you know, that does ballroom dancing, that is a much more sustainable fact because it's not the exercise that's the end game for those things. It's the socialization. It's like, hey, I want to see Betty and John and so on and so forth. And I want to catch up on how their grandkids are doing. And that's doing that in the context of being active is the, in my opinion, the most successful endeavor for a sustained active lifestyle.
To put a cap on this conversation, Dan, and I could easily talk with you for an hour and explore every avenue here. But to put a cap on this, you're never too old, whether it's weight training, going for a walk, just getting active. You're never too old for any of this. Yeah?
Absolutely. And I would like to add, you know, I'm a physical therapist. You know, I'm at the University of Delaware. And a great way to help older adults become active is to make an appointment with a physical therapist and say, hey, I want to get active here and I'm nervous about X, Y, and Z. And can you prescribe, you know, a program for me to help me with that? There are personal trainers as well and other like not in the traditional medical sense of people who can help with that. And I'm definitely supportive of that. But, you know, here in our first state, you have a leading physical therapy school at the University of Delaware. And there are people that would love to talk to you and meet with you to help you become more active.
Thanks to Daniel White, UD Associate Professor of Physical Therapy and Director of the Delaware Active Lab, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters and a look at an upcoming social justice dialogue event in Wilmington designed to promote discourse around social issues and American democracy. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Social justice has meant many things over time, and while definitions may vary, common concepts include equal rights, equal opportunity, and equal treatment. On August 20th, the Delaware Historical Society hosts a social justice dialogue with Dr. Eddie Esclaude Jr., one of the country's most prominent scholars and authors, that aims to challenge attendees to think critically about social issues and the present and future of American democracy. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Delaware Historical Society Executive Director Ivan Henderson and Reverend Ronald Whitaker of the historic Mother African Union Church to learn more about the social justice dialogue.
All right, Ivan, the August quarterly social justice dialogue is coming up. I've been told that this is a very popular event and that you're already getting a lot of registrations from around Delaware. So what can you tell us about this social justice dialogue? You know, some of the context or history behind it and why it's being held.
First of all, thanks for the question and for an opportunity to talk about it. Delaware Historical Society, through its Mitchell Center for African American Heritage, is partnered with Mother African Church, as well as Wilmington Public Library, to present a public forum, public dialogue, during the week of the historic August Quarterly Festival. The festival, of course, you know, was started by the founders of Mother African Church and Peter Spencer in 1814, a year after the church's incorporation. And I've learned from Reverend Whitaker and others that, you know, it was considered the Black State of the Union. Beyond a religious gathering, it was a place to build community, to renew connections during a time when it was illegal for African Americans to gather without this sort of mandate and without the you know, incorporation of a religious community to back up this festival. So it was a way to do things when folks couldn't do things, a way to exchange information, exchange ideas that would advance their common plight. So having this public dialogue and you know, our entry into the conversation is as a partner and to amplify something that's already going on. It's a chance to expand the platform, expand the audience, and also, you know, renew the commitment to having a part of the week that discusses Black political ideology, social justice issues, and futuristic thoughts for the advancement of African-American communities. Those who made places when they couldn't, and those who make places using legal means and new technology these days. And so we wanted a chance to amplify that message by Mother African Church.
Well, this dialogue will at least be led in part by Dr. Eddie S. Glaw Jr., who is one of the country's most prominent scholars and authors, which, and I noted this off air, but as someone who's very familiar with his work, that's very exciting. But for those that don't know, can you give us some insight into Glaw and his background?
I'll actually defer to Reverend Whitaker on much of it. However, I will say that having an opportunity to work with Dr. Glaude and bring someone who's nationally and internationally known, but also a friend to the region, to Delaware, again, is building a bridge between communities, but also bringing a very familiar and trusted voice into the discourse. Dr. Glaude, in his writing and in his work, comfortably, and I think adeptly, straddles the line between the practices of faith communities, as well as sort of Black structured organizations and African-American social realities. He sort of moves comfortably in between those spaces. And again, so not a person who will come here to preach to us, but a person who understands the context of gatherings that are engineered by faith communities and faith leaders, and the messages that you can spread and the thoughts that you can impart at such gatherings. And so he's a master at that in other places, and we're happy to amplify it in downtown Wilmington. But I'll defer to Reverend Whitaker for a little bit more on Dr. Glaude.
Yeah, well, thank you, my dear friend, Ivan and Cal. We share your sentiments just in terms of just the presence of Dr. Eddie S. Glaude. He's not just an academic, and I say that as someone who's also in academia as a tenure track professor, where his work just does not sit beyond the ivory towers. He makes it extremely practical, but at the same time, he's pushing us to think about issues that we're currently grappling with, but from a historical context. So, you know, Dr. Glaude, being a distinguished professor at an institution such as Princeton University, being a political commentator on MSNBC, but most importantly, as it relates to the gathering on the 20th, being a public intellectual that is really causing us to think and to think critically, to think courageously, but also to have a historical lens with the ways that we are framing contemporary problems of practice. So for this conversation, we are super excited as we're going to intersect some of his previous writings, such as The Black Church is Dead, which he penned in 2010, which is still very popular within faith spaces. But we're going to intersect that with some of his most recent writings and really just have a great dialogue about, you know, where we are and where we are trying to go as a community.
Well, Reverend, we'll stick with you here. And you touched on some of what I'm about to ask, but Glaude's talk will be followed by an audience Q&A, a question and answer session with you. So between the Q&A and Glaude's talk, is there anything specifically you're hoping comes out of it in terms of a goal, for lack of a better word? You know, in other words, what are you hoping the audience comes away with or takes away from this social justice dialogue?
That's a super important question. I want the audience to really leave this discourse understanding that leadership is not just trite rhetoric, and leadership is just not something we throw out without it being grounded substantively. And really, this is what this conversation is all about. What does contemporary leadership look like in reviving not only the Black church, but our communities? Now, why do I make that connection, particularly within urban spaces and spaces that are filled with individuals of African descent? We cannot leave out the critical importance of the Black church. Out of the Black church, so many of our primary institutions were birthed. And we're seeing the need for the Black church and also other institutions to really grapple with leadership, and leadership that is grounded substantively, leadership that has a connection to history, but also has contemporary ways and culturally relevant ways for it to be operationalized in the present. So, you know, once again, we want the audience to lead that conversation with the courage and the convictions and just a commitment to really build on the leadership legacies of some of our great ancestors.
Well, there's a lot of history here. You're covering all sides, and I think the importance is clear. And the festival and the things that make it up in this dialogue event, they really go hand in hand beautifully. It sounds like one almost feeds the other, and it's great to hear insight into that from both you and Ivan, and how the dialogue and the festival and its subsequent events, you know, present now and you know, the meaning in a time like this. But Ivan, we'll finish with you here. The August Quarterly Social Justice Dialogue will take place at Wilmington Public Library August 20th from 6 to 8 p.m. What should people do if they're interested in going or finding more information out about it?
Thank you for asking. More information is at our website, www.dehistory.org, but also at the augustquarterly.org website, as well as the Wilmington Public Library website. In all spaces, the event is advertised. As of this moment, it is sold out. We are doing some work to try to add some capacity and may be able to release a flood of seats. But to be honest, we're excited about the response so far. We will also have top-notch recording of the event that will allow us to share it. We won't live stream it, but will allow us to share it over multiple platforms in the weeks and months to follow. So folks can get a glimpse of this event, participate possibly in person, but more importantly, get the record of it and bear witness after the fact through all of our institutions' websites and media portals. I'll just add, I want to go back. I should have introduced, and I'm not joking, I should have introduced Reverend Dr. Ronald Whitaker. In addition, again, to being the leader of Mother African Church, he himself is a thought leader. So it's great to partner in service as the Historical Society to highlight uniquely Delaware history that precedes all other histories in the incorporation of this Black church. And therefore, you know, the foundation pouring for this faith community that endures today. We hope through these types of partnerships to highlight history, to activate information, and try to agitate, you know, our collective problem-solving intellect as we look at the present and future. We want to embolden our better angels that heal and grow community, just as Mother African and multiple other related institutions have throughout Delaware and regional history. But we also want to create sustainable community through fellowship and collective critical thinking. And that's part of the annual tradition and the nearly unbroken chain of the August Quarterly Gathering and this type of public discourse. So again, thank you for a chance to talk about it. We're grateful to be in a position as a historical society to serve community needs in this way. And we hope to see everyone there.
Thanks to Delaware Historical Society Executive Director Ivan Henderson, Reverend Ronald Whitaker of the historic Mother African Union Church, and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And we've reached the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki, and Delaware Public Media senior producer Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again Tuesday for another special edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.